You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
I'm really excited today. Have one of my favorite writers on the show. Many people might not know who he is, even though he's 30 years old, has already written 6 books, has one of the books being made into a movie by Seth Rogen and another book being made into a movie by Jason Reitman. And he's doing a sitcom with one of my favorite actors, Jay Baruchel. So we're going to have on the show today Simon Rich talking about not only his process, but what it takes to be funny, what's a comedy, and so on. So welcome to Simon Rich. By the way, this is just an intro, so I'm recording this intro after the interview, so if it feels weird, don't worry about it.
This is a great, this is a cool building.
Yeah, you should, have you ever done like an audiobook in here?
I might have.
They do a lot of audiobooks here.
Yeah.
So I've done some books here.
That was cool.
As long as everyone's comfortable and all that.
Yeah, all good.
Should be good. I'll bring in the water.
Oh, thank you.
And if you want coffee or anything, we got some outside.
I'd love a cup of coffee. Is that all right? Yeah, thanks so much.
Just black coffee?
Black's great. All right. Thank you.
I'm good, yeah.
All right. Is this comfortable? Do you want to move around? This is a very light setup, this guy, so we can move it around if we need, you know what I mean?
I'm good. Can you hear, as long as you can hear me?
Yeah, I'll just set this up.
Yeah.
And I try to give you some sort of line of sight as best we could in this little space.
Have you done a lot of podcasts or anything?
I've done some.
I've done some, too.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I feel like they've really exploded, and like it's like a huge... last 5 years, like, it was a real growth industry.
Yeah, but at the same time, do you know anyone who's actually listened to a podcast?
I feel like
everyone's
there, right?
Doing one, but I don't know of anyone who listens to any. I mean, although to be fair, a lot of people download this podcast. I just don't know any of them. Uh-huh. Like, so I haven't listened to any podcasts.
Oh, yeah?
So.
What do I listen to? Posting and Toasting, New York Knicks podcast sometimes.
Okay.
And I listen to, what's the Jalen Rose one sometimes?
I don't know.
Yeah. I listen to some basketball ones.
I listen to some comedy ones, actually, like Mark Maron.
Oh, cool.
WTF and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick.
I've heard of those, yeah.
Yeah. And then I've tried Adam Carolla. Well, Adam Carolla's come on my podcast,
uh-huh.
And I probably should have listened to his podcast before then, but
uh-huh.
I didn't.
Uh-huh.
So I listened to it afterwards, though.
I listened to Adam Carolla when he was, he had like a sex call-in show, right?
He had the Man Show with Jimmy Kimmel.
But I thought he also maybe had like a radio, like early, like...
Yeah, he had like Dr. Drew.
Yes.
Yeah, he was
that
on
was
Dr.
him,
Drew.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when it was a radio show.
Yeah.
I used to listen to that when I was a kid, like on you know, FM radio.
Now he does podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, he does the... Dr. Drew does a podcast too. So I just want to make sure. So are we recording now or...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, good. We're moving.
Simon Rich having water.
Having water.
On the podcast.
Yeah.
And coffee.
Coffee should be up.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
So I've read all your books.
Wow, thank you.
So,
thanks for reading them.
Yeah, no, they were hilarious. They were like, you know, how many times do you read a book where you start laughing in the middle of the book? Like, seriously, how many books have there been?
Oh, I can name a bunch, probably.
I can't name that many. I can name your books.
Oh, thank you.
And, I can't name that many others.
Matt Groening, those Life is Hell books, Love and Hell.
Okay, yeah. But those are like comic strips.
Yeah, comic strips. They're
intentionally made to make you laugh.
Yeah.
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 So, what are the like written books have made you laugh out loud? Like, I've seen some books that you've recommended in other interviews.
Yeah.
And they're not like, some of them are like serious, hardcore books.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, well, you know, it's
and they make you laugh.
Well, laughter is such a, you know, like actual physical laughter is so subjective. I mean, it's like the physical response. It's sort of unfair to use that as a metric, I think. Like a lot of my favorite writers and a lot of the writers that I think are the, you know, personally the funniest don't actually make me laugh out loud.
Yeah, that's interesting because you look at like take laughter as a metric. So you were one of the youngest writers ever for Saturday Night Live. Clearly, the metric there is because it's a live audience.
Absolutely,
is laughter.
It's the only metric. I mean, you know, you do a dress rehearsal at 10 p.m. on Saturday night, and the show's 2 hours long at that point, and then Lauren cuts it to 90 in time for the 11:30 broadcast.
And so they're doing the same sketches?
Identical, yeah.
Okay.
And you make some changes and some tweaks and cuts frantically, you know, at around 11 p.m. To try to fix some holes. But mostly at that point in the week, it's just cutting the sketches that got no laughs. So I think at that show in particular, laughter is king. I mean, Lauren will, if he really believes in something, he'll put it on even if it got fewer laughs in another sketch. But the laugh track is, you know, the actual physical volume of the crowd is about as important a rubric as any.
And it's funny because so Lorne Michaels, who essentially created and is like the god of Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. he famously doesn't laugh at anything, right? Like, so when...
Well, that's true, though, of all comedy writers.
Okay.
Yeah, and Lorne, you know, is a comedy writer. Like, he is, and now he's more known for being, you know, an incredibly powerful and influential producer, but he started off as a highly successful comedy writer. And I don't think I've ever met a comedy writer who laughs at jokes.
I wonder. So, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, you see him laughing at jokes. You know, like I've seen him on like Letterman. Well, he laughs at people.
It's a little different. I just, you know, when I show if we're in my writer's room, which is a few blocks from here, and I say to, you know, my staff, like, we should really watch this Mr. Show sketch because it's very similar to the premise that we're trying to pull off here. Let's learn from this great sketch. I'll play it. The entire room will watch it in silence. Huh. And then afterwards, everybody will say, that was brilliant, that was perfect. We have to copy it. We need to be more like it. But none of us will actually physically laugh. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. You've seen everything so many times.
That's funny, though, because so Mr. Show, I remember well because I did the website for Mr. Show.
Oh, cool.
And I was working at HBO at the time, and it was 16 years ago. So how old were you? You must have, we were probably watching them.
Oh, sure. I was 14.
So, and they were, like, unbelievable, right? They blew your mind?
Blew my mind, yeah.
It was, like, the best sketch show on TV at the time, I think.
Yeah, and there were a lot of good ones, too, you know, at that time. But even among that crowd, it stood out to me anyway. I also was a huge fan of Kids in the Hall, which I, of course, was watching a little bit delayed because I was watching it, in reruns on Comedy Central. So in my brain, those shows were contemporaneous. I know that that's not true, but that's how I processed it. And then also The State, which had just ended around that time. Those three shows were just juggernauts.
It seems like in the mid-90s, there was like this flurry of sketch shows and comedians that came out of the mid-90s that just sort of flourished after that. Like, and they were all performing on, like, the guys from The State,
the whole,
Kids
like,
in the
yeah.
Hall, they were all performing on Ludlow Street at the
time. Sure, sure.
So I don't know if you ever went to those at the age of 14, but that was pretty hilarious. Mark Maron was hosting a lot of those.
Right. That was a little bit before my time. I do remember early days of UCB in New York City. I went to some of those shows when I was in high school.
And those were also performing on Ludlow Street.
Right.
Like Amy Poehler would be just this comedian out of nowhere performing on Ludlow Street.
But I knew UCB mainly from their Comedy Central sketch show. So I knew them more as a... Because I was a kid, I wasn't out going to these.
You weren't drinking?
No, I wasn't going to the clubs.
Picking up girls?
Not really. But I was I was watching. I was VHS taping hours of Upright Citizens Brigade comedy off of Comedy Central. And
so that's interesting. So from an early age, did you know you wanted to be in comedy writing, or were you just fascinated by it? Like, you just loved it more than any other kind of form of entertainment?
It's both, right? It's sort of the same thing. I think with most people who make stuff for a living, it starts off from being a fan, being an obsessive fan. And if you love comic books and you read them obsessively for years and years, odds are sooner or later you're going to try to draw a comic book. Or, you know, if you love guitar solos, probably sooner or later you will pick up a guitar. So it's hard to say where one stops and one ends.
Well, okay, so where did one end and one start for you? Like, when did you you first were writing, before Saturday Night Live even, you were, like, writing for The New Yorker already. So, like, what was, like, the first thing you wrote?
Well, before that,
this was, like, funny?
Well, before that, I was writing for Mad Magazine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, when I was in college, and those were the first pieces I really published when I was, in my early 20s. But I was ripping off my favorite comedy writers, you know, from the age of 4 or 5. I remember by 6 years old, I was passing off semi-plagiarized Roald Dahl stories as my own, you know, to my teacher. And I was always trying to copy my heroes.
And did they uncover you? Did they unmask your plagiarizing?
Yeah, I would always get caught pretty quickly in those days. Now these days I'm a little bit better at hiding where I've stolen things from.
So, you know, because there's the saying, of course, good artists plagiarize and great artists steal. So, you know, you always have to kind of go for it. So no one ever knows, really.
Well, my favorite premises are so old-fashioned that they've been done a million times. You know, my favorite comedy games are thousands of years old.
Like, what do you mean by a comedy game?
Like a character who is naively missing a key fact to their survival,
kind of a recurring character in your books is God.
Sure.
So,
yeah,
you
know, right.
And what you remove from God is not quite omnipotence, because he's still, like, all powerful somehow, but you make him human, and that's the funny part. Like, he's not God.
Yeah,
he's not godlike.
That's my favorite thing. I mean, you know, a fallible figure who is responsible for everybody's life. I mean, but that's as old, that certainly goes back directly to Homer Simpson being, you know, safety, in charge of safety for a nuclear power plant. But you can trace that back to, you know, 100 other antecedents that are way older.
You could probably trace it back to the Bible, actually.
Exactly.
This guy was pretty brutal in the
exactly,
Bible.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, when I was reading the Old Testament and Hebrew school, it that's something that did make me laugh out loud, because I couldn't believe how funny and irrational some of his demands were. He literally goes up to a 99-year-old man, right? Already a conversation between a 99-year-old man and God sounds like a Monty Python premise. And he says to him, you know, the first thing he says is, I'm God. You know, all the gods that you've been taught about are false, and I'm the one true God. So already that's a big swing. Then Abraham buys in, and then immediately, like literally like the second sentence he says is, now you have to circumcise yourself. I mean, can you imagine? You're just like wandering through the desert.
You laughed about that, but I didn't as a kid in Hebrew school.
But you're laughing about it now.
I am laughing about it now because the way
then
you say
it. Then he goes even crazier. Then and Abraham crazily agrees to this. And then God says, this is like the third sentence he said to Abraham. He says, now you have to circumcise every single man in your household, including all of your slaves. So now you have to picture Abraham, like, calling all his slaves together and saying, like, hey, guys, listen up. Like, spoke to the new God. You got to cut off your dicks. I mean, what a crazy day that is for everyone. And it's nobody's fault. It's just the situation. But those kinds of premises have always cracked me up.
So it's funny, though, because there's definitely kind of a skill of observation there. Like, so in Hebrew school, obviously, we were all like, okay, God did that. We were going to get tested on this. So you had to just memorize what was happening.
Sure, right.
You couldn't take a step back
and say, 99 years
that
old.
Is screwed up, like,
screwed
what he's
up.
Doing here.
I talk about coming on strong. Hey, I'm God. Cut off your penis. I mean, right to the penis thing.
Yeah, and then it doesn't stop. Then he had to kill his kid.
Then really, yeah, he pulls
to, like,
it back at the end.
Put his wife out into the woods.
Exactly, right. It's nuts.
And it never stopped, actually. Like,
no,
Isaac, Jacob, Moses, they were all... Any contact with God actually was a really screwed up situation.
Really,
like, if God
up.
Was going to come down to you in a burning bush, your life was over after that.
Totally.
Like, Moses could have been, like, a prince, and instead, he everything bad happened to him.
Everything bad. And, yeah, and then he gets lost, and then, you know, for decades. Decades of being lost for decades.
Right. And then his reward was he had to see Israel, but not go there.
Yeah, exactly.
So his life was just over as soon as the burning bush happened.
And it was just all downhill.
But, you know, it's funny because you don't really see, like, religion has taken sort of a back seat in American culture, I feel, in general. And you have quite a bit about, you know, your last novel was essentially about two angels who kind of fall in love while God is planning an Asian fusion restaurant.
Right.
And going to do the apocalypse first.
Yeah.
So
yeah, what in God's name? Yeah, that's God decides to retire, to pursue his first love, which is being a restaurateur, and he tells a couple of angels. It's sort of like heaven's depicted as like this gigantic conglomerate called Heaven Inc. And God's kind of the out to lunch CEO, and he's got a inbox full of prayers that never get answered, and. Most of the prayers are hopeless. You know, it's extremely difficult to answer the prayers. It requires a lot of technical skill, and God's more of an ideas man. And so he tells a couple of plucky angels, you know, if you can answer one of these prayers, I'll keep the earth open. And so they pick an easy one, they think, which is that two humans have prayed to be with one another. And how hard can that be? They both want to hook up. So all they have to do is facilitate it. But the humans are so... romantically inept that Earth ends up being in peril anyway.
Yeah. No, that was hilarious. And then now, so before Saturday Night Live, you wrote your first book,
Ant Farm.
Ant Farm, yeah. And it was almost like they were almost like stand-up bits, I felt. Like they were very short, like one or two pages each story, and each one kind of it was like the classic kind of here's a premise and then here's a punchline sort of thing. Like, I felt like you could have done this as stand-up. Did you ever consider doing stand-up?
Stand-up is an extremely hard skill. You need to be really, you need to be charismatic. You need to be confident. You need to have good timing. It's unbelievably difficult. It's like... one amazing thing is that you can be a hilarious stand-up comedian and not be a very good writer. You know, it's such an amazing skill set that if you have that skill set and that alone, you can actually end up having a lot of success. And if you're both, if you happen to have both stand-up skills and comedy writing skills, then, I mean, you can be world famous. But there isn't necessarily any overlap. Most of the funniest... I know a lot of stand-up comedians who are brilliant writers, but, you know, you're kind of born into this world with various talents, and you don't really know what you're going to get.
How do you know have you tried stand-up? Like, how do you know?
I just know myself to be a terrible performer. I can tell from reading my pieces out loud in front of people. And also, you know, usually stand-up comedians, they love performing, you know, just like how I love writing. I wake up in the morning and I'm really excited to sit down and write. I can't wait to do it. Whereas the thought of going up on a stage in front of a lot of people is, I find, really scary. Stand-ups are excited. They can't wait to get on stage. That's like a baseball player playing baseball. So it's a very, very different thing than I do.
Do you write every day?
Yeah.
7 days a week?
Mm-hmm.
First thing in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so you wake up and do you do kind of the Hemingway technique of, okay, I'm going to finish the day before knowing what the next sentence is so that you're all ready to go? Or do you have no idea? Do you try to start from scratch on an idea when you wake up?
It varies. So, I mean, it depends on what I'm doing. Like, if I'm in the middle of a screenplay, then like, yeah, I know that the next day it's going to probably be the next scene in the screenplay. But if I'm between projects, then yeah, it'll be that's when I write new stuff.
So I just kind of want to give some highlights because we jumped right into it. You've written like, I want to say 6 books. Is that right? The last one, Spoiled Brats. I don't even think it's available in the U.S. yet.
No, like it's, yeah, a few
it
more
was
weeks.
Published in the U.K.
Mm, yeah.
And I read part of it. I read Sellout, which was in the New Yorker.
Cool.
So that was like a novella, and it was very different. I felt it was very different from your prior books, but we'll talk about that in a second. So then you've also been one of the youngest writers of Saturday Night Live. You did that for like 3 years, 2 years?
Four.
4 years. Okay, so longer than I thought. Then you were at Pixar working on God knows what. Like the interview I saw, you weren't allowed to even talk about what you worked on. Are you still not allowed to talk about what you worked on?
No, I can't, yeah.
Has the movie come out or is it not coming out? Or
I can't say a thing.
You
yeah,
can't say a thing.
I know, it makes it sound much cooler than it is, but it's just
like the CIA.
I know, exactly, yeah.
And then now you're working on a sitcom.
Right.
And plus two of your books are being looked at as for movies. So Seth Rogen bought the rights of one, I guess, and Jason
Sellout,
Reitman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Seth Rogen bought Sellout?
Yeah, him and Evan Goldberg, yeah.
That's really interesting. So who's going to play the Simon character and the great-grandfather? Who are going to, do you
Good
know?
Good question, yeah. We're still trying to, we're working that out.
Are you, so when you say you're working on a screenplay, do you work on these things? Are they going to let you write the screenplay, or is Seth Rogen going to write the screenplay?
I'm writing that screenplay.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I was working on this morning.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fun one. It's been great working with those guys. They're really smart, really funny. I'm really grateful that they are taking a chance on something as weird as that story.
And it's a little different for them too, I think. Like, first off, my all-time favorite movie of all time is Superbad. Which is Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg.
Yeah.
So they're incredible.
They're great. I mean, I've
and
been
they've been doing it since
years.
They were kids, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's like a YouTube thing with Seth Rogen at his doing stand-up like at the age of 13.
Right, right.
So, and he, I guess he practiced stand-up also a bit for funny people.
Mm-hmm.
So, which was very funny. But so what was the, what's the other one? What's the Jason Reitman one?
That was he bought the rights to my first novel, which was called Elliot Allagash.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Very very funny. So Elliot Allagash, the premise is there's a guy who's
Fallon.
A nerd, and there's another guy who's super rich who does this Pygmalion type thing. He's gonna make the nerdy kid cool.
Yeah, it's this evil teenager named Elliot, and he's been expelled from every school in the world. And his dad is the richest man on earth, so he just perpetually is buying him into new prep schools. And this time, his dad has given so much money to the school in question that he literally cannot get expelled. For the first time, he's stuck at a school. And so for sport as a game, but really because he's lonely and wants a friend, we find out he systematically takes the least popular kid and turns him into the most popular kid as a, you know, in classic My Fair Lady style. And it's very expensive, but and there are a lot of hijinks. And
yeah, like sort of, guy, like,
pretty,
like
pretty
we all wish we had like an Elliot Allagash
yeah,
in our lives.
He's like a fairy godmother.
Yeah.
But yeah, but
it turns bad.
It turns bad, yeah. As these things do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like that's an extremely old story. A lot of what I do is just like taking an old story that I love and I've seen a million times and just trying to do it in my own way. That's really how I look at it. I think like, okay, like I, you know.
So what was the old story there? Like what's a classic
that's
example?
Like a
we see, of course, Judy Blume.
Sure.
You know, or any kind of young adult novels
right.
as that sort of premise.
Right.
But what would you say is the most close to that you were able to kind of make a slight comic twist and here we go?
Well, My Fair Lady, obviously,
yeah.
Pygmalion. I would say for that one, any Sell Your Soul to the Devil story, you know, from Dr. Faustus to Damn Yankees, anything where a character is at the bottom of the ladder and says, man, I will do anything to get to the top. And then, you know, you see the flash of smoke and the evil charismatic devil appears and says, you know, anything, and then you're off to the races. It's just such a fun starting point for a story.
I feel like that happens a lot, like, for instance, in South Park.
Sure, all the time.
So
Yeah. They do it, Twilight Zone, Simpsons. I mean, everyone has milked that premise. It's a lot of fun.
Gosh, I should start stealing from your stuff. Maybe I'll write some funny stuff. I'll, like, just go through each thing. So
yeah, I mean, some people are even more reductionist about it. Some people say that there are only, like, two plots or three. I think there's more like a dozen. But
Well, I could see at least three or four in your stuff. So there's kind of, like, the nerdy kid who's trying to figure out the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that happens a lot in your books, particularly the earlier ones.
Mm-hmm.
Then you transitioned, and now it's like guy in 20s in a relationship, and things can go wrong. And like you, it's sort of like you take common problems in relationships and then move them into an extreme situation, and then that's the comedy. It's like, so for instance, the guy who meets a girl in a bar, goes home with her, spends the night, and that's such an incredible thing. He gets a call from the president the next day.
Right. And he wins a MacArthur Genius Prize.
Yeah.
Yeah, for successfully wooing a girl at a bar. Yeah.
She becomes the face of Dior.
Yeah, she also gets a lot of attention for her achievement too. Yeah, they both become international celebrities.
So did you think of that, like, when you were sitting in a bar and, like, gosh, I just can't, it's impossible to meet a girl?
With all these stories, it's sort of like you start off with a visceral emotion that I start off with, like, a visceral emotion that I have felt. And if I think that it's universal, if I think it's something that probably is not unique to my own experience, then I'll try to write about it. And the way I try to write about it is by coming up with a very high stakes, usually supernatural premise, which will get across how extreme that emotion feels, you know? So I try to write about emotions, that I've experienced, not in the way that they actually occurred, but in the way that they felt. So, you know, when you meet somebody new and it goes well, that's a pretty low-stakes, boring story, but when you're in it, when you're living it, it feels about as high-stakes as anything could be. So that's why that character gets a congratulatory call from the president, because that's how it feels to him.
Well, and so that was in The Last Girlfriend on Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so then there was another story where a guy's about to decide whether he's going to go into a long-term relationship or not, and he goes to, like, a boot camp to convince him not to, like, the, or he goes to, like, a prison.
Like Scared Straight.
Yeah.
So that's about a guy who's, like, on the verge of entering he's entering a serious long-term relationship with a woman, and he's really on the path towards marriage, and he and a bunch of other young boyfriends find themselves in a Scared Straight program where instead of getting a tour of prison, they're getting a tour of the suburbs and married life and they're forced to look at, you know, Bed Bath and Beyond and
you make fun of, like, the guy says, have you ever read Junot Diaz before? And
right, they're told that they're gonna have to join book clubs and they're sort of, their faces are rubbed in the misery of monogamous married yuppie life, and they end up all getting out of Dodge and breaking up with their girlfriends.
And what was the final? There was a final triggering event that scared this guy into tears. The main protagonist of that story.
I don't even remember what it was, because
you write so many stories, so it's hard to kind of, like, remember each one.
Yeah, and also I then will change it for, so, like, that's now, that scene is now in an episode of the sitcom that I'm doing, and so it's been rewritten and adapted. So I,
oh, that's funny.
I'm so
you steal
far
from yourself.
Oh, constantly, yeah. Every chance I get.
Yeah, because ultimately, like, if there's, let's say there's four premises, you've got to figure out a different way to slice each premise.
Exactly.
So, like, for instance, we talked about, so let's say there's the God is human story mixed with the relationship story. So you have one story, and I think this is also in The Last Girlfriend on Earth. You have one story where God is creating the earth one day at a time, and it's good, and you're using biblical language, and then suddenly his girlfriend is very upset. He's spending so much time on his earth. He doesn't want to correct her. It's a universe. And she just wants to go see the Muppets or
whatever. Yeah, well, that's right. That's about a kind of selfish character in his 20s who doesn't make time for his girlfriend and is too work-centric. And you find out in the story that he's also God. So his particular job is to create this universe. But he learns that he learns to have some more work-life balance by the end.
So just that premise is funny. God with a work-life balance.
Right, yeah.
So it's the intersection of premises that become funny.
Yeah.
Would you say it's losing a premise or intersection? Because, like, a lot of times the comedy comes from God loses a skill. For instance, loses the ability to be the most universally powerful person in the universe. Like, because now his girlfriend has power over him.
He
lost a skill there. Or is it the intersection of girlfriend-boyfriend dynamics with the Bible?
That's interesting. I think those are two ways of putting it. I think those are both right. You know, like, it's those are both good ways of describing it. At the core of any comedy premise, there needs to be, I think, some vulnerability somewhere. Somebody has to be weak.
Like a non-hero.
Most heroes usually have a weakness, right? You know, I think for somebody
The Rock never has a weakness.
Except for The Rock. He's always killing it.
Yeah. Although he likes little boys. He's a little boy, you know, like if he suddenly adopts a son or a son is dropped off in his apartment.
Absolutely. Yeah, Hollywood's usually pretty good about giving all their heroes a bit of vulnerability.
So now, how did this sitcom? First, I wanted to ask you about The Sellout. Because this is another premise which was very unique to you, actually. Like, I feel like you sort of grow up in Spoiled Brats, and starting with this novella, The Sellout. The main character, it has nothing to do with, you know, relationships or anything like that. This the main protagonist. Becomes friends in this, as you say, this fantastic way. He suddenly becomes friends with his great-great-grandfather or great-grandfather who moves forward in time so they're the same age and they can become pals with each other.
Yeah, it's autobiographical. It's about my ancestor, this guy named Herschel, and he's a hardscrabble Jewish immigrant from Eastern Europe, and he comes to this country with very little, and in the story, and this is where it gets fictional, he is working at his job at the pickle factory, and he falls into a vat of pickles, and the lid gets closed over him by mistake, and he's brined for 100 years. And so when he emerges from the pickle brine in present-day Brooklyn, he hasn't aged a day, and so he's able to meet me. And in the story, we're both the same age; we're both 27, but we have very different takes on the world and very different skill sets. And he's, you know, understandably horrified that his great great grandson has turned into something as frivolous as a comedy writer.
Yeah. So it was very funny, and then he becomes this entrepreneur, like a hardworking guy, in present day society, a hardworking guy could find himself stumbling into great wealth.
That's right, yeah. And he's sort of unwittingly becomes a kind of hipster icon to the people of Brooklyn, and ends up achieving great fame and fortune.
Yeah.
Eclipsing the Simon Rich character.
So this is the one where the movie's in the works, but kind of in the script writing phase.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And now, so what are you working on? So you're working on the sitcom with Jay, I don't know how to say his last name.
Baruchel. Baruchel.
I loved him in This is the End, which is like the funniest movie after Superbad that I've ever seen.
Which is
also Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he's phenomenal. He's, and that movie's great, I think. he's the star of our show, and he's fantastic.
I feel like he's an interesting character because he's very funny. He was great in Undeclared, which also had Seth Rogen in it as an actor.
Right.
Which I guess is where they became friends, or maybe they were friends before then, I don't know. But he was great. He was the main character of Undeclared, which ran, I think, only one season.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was in a couple of movies which were, you know, kind of hits or minor hits or whatever. But he never, like, hit the stratosphere like Seth Rogen did. But he's a hilarious guy. How did it come to be this sitcom?
So it's based on The Last Girlfriend on Earth. The show has a different title. The show is called Man Seeking Woman. I wanted to do it as a full sitcom as opposed to as a sketch show. You would assume that a show that's based on a collection of 30 stories would be a sketch show. But I decided I wanted to do it as a sitcom because I felt that audiences have a tendency to kind of write off sketch shows, and they don't allow themselves to be emotionally compelled by sketch shows.
Yeah, like other than Saturday Night Live, what sketch show exists now? And I mean, there are a couple on Comedy Central.
Oh, they're great,
like Nick
ones.
Kroll show.
Yeah, Kroll and Key and Peele and Amy Schumer. Yeah, these are all great shows.
But outside of Comedy Central,
I think there's. And Broad City is a proper sitcom, but I think there's a lot of great sketch stuff out there. But I meant more just like, it's strange. There are a lot of like moving scenes on Mr. Show, for example, but people would never describe the show as emotionally resonant because. I think because characters are changing identities so rapidly and they're putting on different wigs, you're constantly reminded that it's fake. And when that's happening, as an audience member, you're less likely to allow yourself to get sucked into the emotional aspects of the story. So since these stories that I wrote were about love, since they're love stories, I just wanted to make sure that audiences would be willing to kind of go into those waters with me. So I had to make it into a sitcom.
And it doesn't really, I mean, you look at something like, let's say Family Guy, you know, that's almost like a sketch show, except everybody is the same character. You know, they're just playing different sketches over and over again.
Right, but because they are the same characters, people start to develop a rapport with the character. They start to, to feel like they've developed a kind of relationship with, you know, with Peter. And they and Stewie and they get to know them and that allows them to have emotional connections to the work. Whereas like SNL, even if there's an extremely moving sketch, it might never be repeated.
Yeah, I think people SNL become loyal to the actors.
They become loyal to the actors in the way that but that takes years and years and years because. The actors, again, are constantly putting on crazy facial prosthetics and bizarre wigs. So it takes you like 2 or 3 years of close viewing to even be able to differentiate the different performers. So that's why everybody always dislikes SNL when the cast changes because they always think that it's the cast's fault, which is a funny misconception. It's really,
and it happens each time,
every single time,
like every 4 years people hate SNL.
Every new cast member has been hated since 1980. But the reason why people hated Bill Murray when he started or hated Will Ferrell when he started is because they literally physically did not recognize him, and whereas with the sitcom you're able to say like, this is Bill Cosby. And by, episode 2, 3, you really know who that guy is. He plays the same character for every minute of the show.
Even though there's no real arc across the shows, like they're really just doing the same family is doing another sketch in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
You do feel this emotional connection to who they represent.
And it's really as simple as he always has the same sweater kind of, and he is always in the same house, and he always has the same wife. It really is that simplistic.
So are you having a fun time with this sitcom?
It's a blast, yeah, and it's just like I feel so lucky to work with the people who are doing it with me. It's Jay's brilliant. He's like a unbelievably talented actor and hilarious, obviously, but also just really naturalistic and versatile. And he's just the show would certainly not work without him.
Does he help with the writing at all? Do you find that happening?
It's such a it's interesting. We find ourselves really talking about not so much the nitty gritty of what dialogue is on the page, but we do talk a lot about our personal experiences when we're crafting the show, because it's so important for it to be as universal and relatable as possible. So everybody, I think, involved from the writers to the cast to the directors to the producers are coming into it with their own emotional stories.
So do you have a writing staff, or and are they like pitching different show ideas, or everything's just purely based on the first 30 stories?
It's like of those, probably only about half are really truly adaptable, because so much of them were like really genre parodies,
right?
That kind of require text. So most of the material is brand new.
So the writing staff pitches ideas to you, and you decide what's good and what's bad. Like, how does it work within the writing room?
The writing room is, and again, this is like just, it's an unbelievable group of writers, and I just every day at work, I'm just blown away that I get to work with these people.
Do you feel funny if some of them are older than you?
You know, it's like you kind of forget about that stuff, because the way that we work, it's so collaborative. A lot of the episodes are co-written, and it feels more like being in a rock band than it does like being like boss of a show.
And this is going to go on, do you know what, I forgot what network this is going on.
FXX.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
My favorite.
Yeah.
So I was worried you were going to say like CBS or something. So FXX with the League, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Right,
Louis,
right.
Peter Liguori is still the head of the network, I think. I forget. They seem to have the most original stuff on TV right now.
They've been great for us. I've never had a better experience with the network. They are just super trusting and supportive. And yeah, it's a weird show. I mean, it's a traditional sitcom in the sense that it's about this character played by Jay Baruchel, who is a lovelorn guy in his 20s, and he is getting over heartbreak and trying to meet the right someone. And he has his best friend, and he has his sister, and he has his parents, and he has this dead-end job. It's a very, very by-the-book conventional sitcom. But it's, you know, there's time travel, and there's alien apocalypses, and there's a lot of murder, and there's a lot of there are trolls, there are devils, there are trips to the underworld. So there are a lot of strange elements that and it's miraculous that they've let us get away with it.
When do you think it'll come out?
I think it's supposed to come out in early 15.
Huh. So I can't wait for that.
Yeah, we're going to Toronto now to shoot it.
Oh, okay, shooting in Toronto. I think that's where Jay's from, right?
Yeah.
So that'll be fun.
Serendipitous,
for him.
Yeah. He's from Montreal, but he lives in Toronto now.
Huh.
Yeah.
So I remember in This Is the End, I guess he's coming from Canada to visit his pal Seth Rogen is
right.
The premise.
And, right, yeah.
But he wants to be out of that whole Hollywood scene.
He
ends up like in the middle of the apocalypse there.
Right, exactly. There's some parallels between that movie and our show, you know, because it's obviously like high stakes supernatural elements, but the movie's really about the relationships between the characters.
So I've seen you use this word high stakes in a couple of different interviews. So like it's sort of like you say, I take an emotional reaction and there's some high stakes element to it. So like obviously male female relationships are all high stakes.
Sure,
when
yeah,
you're in them.
Absolutely.
And God's high stakes. And and then do something to it, like mix it up in some way. Like, what's for you? You've been watching so much comedy since you were a little kid. Maybe it's just natural. But like, what's the switch that makes it comic? Do you think?
That's a really good question.
High stakes into comedy.
It's a thin line. I mean, you know, I think it's a real thin line between comedy and horror, for example. A lot of my favorite writers kind of do both, like Shirley Jackson. You know, when you're reading some of her stories, you don't know whether you're supposed to laugh or scream sometimes. I feel
probably the lottery is not very funny, but
well, at the same time, like, you know, with,
all right, give me your version.
I mean, you know, for me, it wouldn't take that many sentences to flip it. You know, all you'd have to do is be like, have somebody say like, "Hey, I won! All right, great. So what?
All right.
What did I win?" You know, and then all of a sudden you're, and it's like, why is everybody looking at me? Is it a car? It's a car, right? I mean, you know, it doesn't take that much to flip something. Same thing with Stephen King. Like, a lot of his premises can be flipped. The Simpsons has been doing it for years, all their Halloween specials. You just take a classic Twilight Zone premise, a high-stakes Twilight Zone premise, and you just tweak it really very slightly, and all of a sudden you've got a great comedy premise.
Okay, so let's take the guy who the famous one where he's in a vault when the world ends.
Sure.
And then he ends up trying to collect all these books, and he's
right.
Happy that no one's bothering him. And then right when he sits down to read, his glasses break and his lifelong dream is over.
Right. So played as a as like an O. Henry, like a serious O. Henry style twist story, right? Like,
right.
And so much of that is just the music and the performance. Whereas, you know, with some tweaks and trims, you could turn that into like a Far Side cartoon, probably.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. So, what out of Family Guy, Simpsons, South Park, what's your favorite?
It's sort of unfair to compare those shows. I feel, you know, it's like comparing like the, you know, the Beatles and like the Kinks and like the Smiths. It's like you have to kind of they're so influential on one another that
I guess it's true, and they all refer to each other.
Sure, and just these aren't shows that came out in the same year. You know, these are shows that came out. You have to look at them in context, obviously the Simpsons is the godfather of comedy, I think, as I know it in the world.
I saw in one interview you would watch like 5 Simpson episodes a day.
Yeah, I for me that pretty much everything I think I know or everything I believe about comedy I learned from The Simpsons.
So you really went through your almost like this virtual apprenticeship on comedy by just immersing yourself in so much, like The Simpsons, Mr.
Yeah.
Show, Saturday Night Live.
But above all, The Simpsons. You know, I loved all these shows, and I loved reading Funny Writers, and I loved The Onion, and I loved reading Douglas Adams. But none of this, all this pales in comparison to The Simpsons. The Simpsons really is, in my mind, the most perfect work of art.
Have you ever tried writing for them?
No, I've never tried to write for them, but Ian Maxtone Graham is working for Man Seeking Woman, working for my sitcom, which is hugely amazing.
Ah, so he used to work on The Simpsons? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, for you know, a decade plus.
Huh.
And he's a brilliant, brilliant writer. And in The Room, I'll constantly say, like, no, we need to make this scene more like this very, very specific, you know, joke or scene or premise on the Simpsons episode. And often Ian will remember when, you know, he or somebody else wrote it, which is a totally surreal experience.
So you mentioned earlier your discipline, like you wake up, you start writing just right away. And then throughout the day, like what happens like later in the day? Like you take care of business?
Yeah.
Or?
Later in the day is like, you know, interviews like this or reading scripts or watching auditions. It's sort of the sort of non-writing aspects of my job.
Because people are auditioning for both the movie and the sitcom?
Yeah, or whatever's going on at the moment.
And then in the evening, do you go to sleep early because you know you're going to have to write the next day? Do you start to get anxious? What am I going to write the next day?
I, Well, that's like, well, I never get anxious about what I'm going to write, because if I don't have anything to work on, that's when I get to come up with something new, which is its own kind of
right.
fun, exciting experience.
Well, like when you started the Sellout, were you thinking, gosh, I've already sliced and diced Man Meets Women, you know, so many times. I've got to come up with something, some new twist, or did it just...
I mean, you can write the same story for your whole life. I mean, look at Philip Roth, right? I mean, you can just keep going on a couple of themes for I've only written 6 books. Some of my favorite writers have
written... only written 6 books. You're age 30, so obviously you're prolific.
But some of my favorite writers have written, you know, 20 or 30 books, and they're all basically about the same thing.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Philip Roth, you could kind of define... And Philip Roth, John Updike, Saul Bellow, that whole 60s crew, you could sort of say they all wrote the same story over and over again. And
yeah,
they
I mean,
all
think about how many
each other
novels,
the same story.
I mean, I'm not a huge Updike fan, but, you know, think about how many solid stories and novels he wrote about infidelity.
Yeah.
Or, like, look at, you know, another one of my heroes is Douglas Adams, right? And all those books are essentially the same. I mean, you forget where one starts and where one ends.
Yeah.
In my mind, they all kind of bleed together into a single awesome story.
And kind of Kurt Vonnegut does
that too. Kurt Vonnegut, yeah, exactly. He literally
makes fun of that. Like, he'll bring characters from one and put them in another.
Another great another one of my favorite writers. He'll literally reference premises.
You mentioned in one of your things, T.C. Boyle is one of your favorite short story writers.
Yeah, love T.C. Boyle.
He's one of mine as well. I don't consider him necessarily like a comedy writer, but he's like definitely like an above and beyond talent.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites. Another example of, you know, is it comedy? Is it horror? Is it somewhere in between? And, like, you know, the truth is it doesn't really matter. It's gripping. It's visceral. It's high stakes. It's emotional and it draws you in. You want to keep flipping the pages. Yeah, he's fantastic, and all of his stories. I mean, and some of the historical novels too. I mean, I love Drop City and I love Road to Wellville. But his stories are my favorite. If There Ever Was Whiskey, Greasy Lake, Descent of Man.
Greasy Lake is one of maybe top 5 short stories of all time.
Oh, it's so good. What about the story? What about the Hector Quesadilla story? That's a great one.
I don't think I've read that one.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of awesome sports stories. And then Stephen King, of course, is also another premise king. All my favorite writers, all the writers that I look up to and try to rip off are premise writers. You know, they're writers who give you a strong hook at the beginning. So it's towards the beginning.
Yeah.
So it's always going to be, for me, it's going to be like Flannery O'Connor and Shirley Jackson as opposed to Updike.
What about like a Raymond Carver where the hook is very subtle?
It's not for me, yeah. Yeah. I respect it. It's extremely hard to do. But my favorite stuff is more like, you know, P.G. Woodhouse or Ray Bradbury.
Yeah,
or Philip Dick, you know, just...
So there's a concept and there's characters.
Yes.
As opposed to being just purely character-driven.
Right. That stuff for me is... I'm impressed by it, but yeah, like, it's not where I live.
Like who do you read where you're so enraptured that it just... It's like you read and then you get up and start writing?
For me, I guess I've probably... talked about most of my favorites, but Roald Dahl for me is his stories, his short stories are, I think, that's like everything I write is just trying to copy that as much as possible.
I've never read any of his short stories.
They're twist stories. They're constructed a little bit like O. Henry stories, but they're not sanctimonious and they're not like moralistic. They're just like ripping yarns that you can't put down. They're amazing. I'd start with I think the Modern Library maybe put out like a huge, like a big ass collection of his. Everything he does is unbelievable. His children's books are also fantastic. He's
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
So good. Yeah, it's great. So he's probably my favorite writer.
And then you mentioned Douglas Adams, Kurt Vonnegut. T.C. Boyle,
The Love Simpsons. Those guys. The Simpsons, yeah, The Simpsons above all. Simpsons above all of these writers.
Simpsons above Mr. Show?
Oh, definitely. But again, it's like, how can, you know, the it's not like David Cross had never watched The Simpsons. You know, it's,
right.
Yeah, all these guys have, I imagine, were at least somewhat influenced by.
So have you ever been disappointed in your career? Like, it seems like from the get-go, you were writing for The New Yorker, you published a collection of short stories, SNL loved the story so much that you became a cast writer, then Pixar, now you're doing a movie and a sitcom. It's sort of like you have, like, this ideal kid's career. Like every 12-year-old would want this career when they grew up.
I certainly feel really grateful that I get to do it. Every single day when I wake up and I don't have to go to a normal job and I get to just sit and write like I did when I was a kid, I feel like it's a miracle. I feel super lucky I get to do it.
So what would you recommend for someone? Let's say someone is 30, okay, and they've been in a cubicle all their life, and or whether they've been a lawyer or whatever, but they also liked The Simpsons when they were younger. They also liked all these things, and they love comedy, and they think they have it in them to be a writer. Is there any advice for them, or is it too late?
I don't think it's ever too late for anyone to do anything. I mean, you know, it's I will say that if you don't love sitting down and writing, you definitely shouldn't do it for a living, because that's mostly what it is. You know, like if you are stuck in a boring job, and every single night you can't wait to get home because the job stinks, and all you really want to be doing is sitting down and writing a novel, then that's somebody who should keep plugging away at it,
right,
and keep writing every day, and you know, and never give up, etc. But if you kind of just, like, in the back of your mind think that you would like to sit down and write,
I'll never do it.
My suggestion would be to sit down and write and see if you really like it. I mean, what's the great Laurie Moore story? It's in a self-help, you know, How to Be a Writer, I think it's called. But you know, her advice in that story is try to do anything else first.
Yeah, interesting. You know, so that's a collection of stories that came out, what, like 20 years ago? So you're really up on all of your short story writers. Like, do you read, how much do you read?
I read a lot. I really like to read. I read mostly, I would say, these days, probably mostly nonfiction, but...
Like what?
I love Alec Wilkinson. I love John Ronson.
Yeah.
You know,
but those are almost like literary nonfiction. Like, they're kind of nonfiction, but it's not... I wouldn't say it's...
It's narrative nonfiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I like... I read a lot of biographies. Yeah, I like, you know... Again, it's the same reason I read everything, because it's like a high stakes crazy story.
Now, do you feel with the sitcom, did you go back and read, okay, what's a typical 30-minute or 22-minute sitcom?
Oh, absolutely,
like,
yeah.
So there's a so what are the elements? There's like an A, B, C story.
Our show, not to get too technical, because it's always so boring to deconstruct these things, but our show is a little bit unusual in that it really centers around a single guy's journey. It's closer to a show like, you know, Louis or Curb Your Enthusiasm, because it really is about the trials and tribulations of one guy. It's
but
not
still
a,
like two or three things happening.
Yes, but it's very laser focused on our star, it's not an ensemble show in the way that Friends is, you know, where in any given episode, you know, you'll have multiple plots.
Right.
It's very much about following the trajectory, the emotional arc of our hero.
And so, okay, so now get technical. Like, what's one level below that?
What do you mean?
In terms of like story structure.
One level below that.
Like you said, you didn't want to get too technical.
Well, I mean, then you get into things like...
Like, is there a first act, second act, third act?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, then you get into... Right, you have to make sure that there's the act breaks. have momentum so that the person will want to keep watching. You have to make sure that, or at least I like to. I like to make sure that...
You have to, because I feel like there's like limited attention in general. Like, let's say you're reading a book. How often do you feel like, okay, I'm done with this chapter, I'm going to check my email again, or I'm going to check Twitter, or I'm going to check Facebook?
Right. Like, I mean, well, exactly. That's all I'm thinking about whenever I write anything, whether it's a novel or a story or an episode of a TV show. All I'm thinking is how do I get somebody to keep watching or reading this, and not check their phone, you know? And I think if they check their phone, it's not because their attention span is short and they're stupid. I think it's because I did a bad job as a storyteller.
So you almost need like a cliffhanger at the end of every line in a weird way.
I try to. It doesn't have to necessarily be a literal cliffhanger where it's like, you know, is he going to live or die? Although that's one of my favorite tricks. It could be a joke that makes them laugh. That usually will keep somebody reading. Could be like a emotional cliffhanger where, you know, you're invested in the character's journey and you don't know which decision they're going to make. There's a lot of ways to, you could scare the shit out of the reader as Stephen King does every like couple of pages.
Right.
There's a lot of ways to keep somebody, you know, to keep their nose in the book. But, you gotta keep them there because then if you don't, they'll run.
So what's the next thing now? Is Spoiled Brats coming out in the U.S. soon?
Yeah, so Spoiled Brats comes out here, I think, in like a month.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
I ordered it somehow, but maybe I got it from like a used someone who got it in the U.K. and
right,
selling it here.
Yeah, it's weird. It's not out here because it's they did it first over in the U.K.
Yeah, but you could Google, though, this Find the Sellouts novella because it's in The New Yorker.
Right, yeah.
So, what's the Jay Baruchel sitcom going to be called?
It's going to be called Man Seeking Woman.
Oh, Man Seeking Woman.
Yeah.
Early 2015.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks for, I really appreciate you reading all my stuff. You know, it's like a lot of these interviews, people will not have read any of the books, and which is fine. I get, you know, because I know people are busy, but it really means a lot to me that you took the time.
No, I was laughing out loud reading this stuff. So I called Tucker Max actually to call his contacts to find you, and they found you.
Cool.
So I'm glad you came on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. What a really
and you've definitely inspired some of my. So you probably haven't read anything I've written, but because it's a totally different type of stuff. But I've definitely ripped you off a little bit in my own blog posts and essays that I write.
Oh, cool.
So
I can't wait to check it out.
Yeah, I'll send you one where I totally ripped you off.
Oh, great!
And people liked it, but they were like, "This is like a strange new version of James." So, and I couldn't go from there. I've ripped off you and BJ Novak because he has
very
similar flavor to your stuff.
He's great. Yeah, we have a lot of the same influences for sure.
And that's why I felt like with one more thing, BJ Novak's book, a lot of that came from stand-up ideas he had, which he expanded into stories.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wondered if you had ever considered stand-up.
Right. Well, that's a guy who's obviously a brilliant writer, but he also happens to be a great actor and performer,
right.
Which is just like, I mean, that's like knowing how to play guitar and sing. Like, what are the odds? You know, and if you can do both of those, it's extremely impressive.
So for, like, comedians, and you've written for so many of them, who, like I sort of see, like, someone like Andy Samberg, who you must have written mm-hmm. for on SNL.
Oh, yeah.
That guy's, like, an unbelievable talent.
Yes.
And
a great writer.
And a great writer, because he does all the, with his team, he does the Lonely Island stuff.
Right, and, yeah, he's an excellent writer. I've written sketches with him. He's phenomenal.
Does he contribute a lot to this sketch?
Totally. Yeah, he's an A+ full. You know, he's somebody who if he wasn't in the cast of SNL, surely could have been a writer for the show.
Because
that's true of most of the cast. In fact, a lot of them are excellent writers.
Didn't they? Most of them start as writers. Like, didn't like Andy Samberg start as a writer, or was he always on the cast?
No, but you're thinking of maybe of Jason Sudeikis started as a writer. Yep, and. Who else? Yeah, and he's not the only. Yeah, Tina Fey started as a writer.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of, but, you know, again, just like, wow, you know, most of, like, in my writer's room, for example, there isn't a single one of us who would ever be able to be on camera. SNL, though, is they seem to find a lot of writers who can do both, which is a rare, special thing.
Yeah, maybe because Lorne Michaels is a writer, he can kind of recognize both qualities when mm-hmm. he auditions them.
Yeah.
Look at, like, Jimmy Fallon, for instance.
Right, exactly, yeah. Right, and Lorne actually was on camera a bit in his early days. He had a show in Canada.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, where he mostly played like straight man parts. He wasn't like stretching too much, but when he was starting out in entertainment, he was on both sides of the camera.
Well, again, I want to really thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And good
Thanks
luck
for having
with
me.
Spoiled Brats. I highly recommend. I want to read off the titles of all your books so people know what to get. But I've got to find the list because there's so many of them. Hold on one second. I've got it here. So and all of them were great. I have to say I devoured them right away, and they're all pretty easy to read. Not in the sense that you don't use fancy vocabulary or anything, but they're all pretty good reads for speed. The Last Girlfriend on Earth and Other Love Stories, Ant Farm and Other Desperate Situations, What in God's Name, a novel, Free Range Chickens, Elliot Oligash, a novel, and then Spoiled Brats. Now, the one thing I haven't read, actually, is The Married Kama Sutra.
Oh, yeah. The Married Kama Sutra. That's a book of cartoons that my friend Farley Katz drew.
Okay, and then you wrote the dialogue, or?
Yeah, I did the captions. Yeah, that's based on a New Yorker. It's a small like gag book.
Okay.
It's based on a comic that we did for the New Yorker, which was, a lost chapter of the Kama Sutra, which is positions for married people. So the positions are, you know, a little less erotic and a little more kind of just a little
kitchen.
More, yeah, a lot of it has to do with the dishwasher.
That's funny. Well, I just ordered it as we were talking.
Oh,
so.
Thank you.
So now I have your full collection.
Unbelievable. You're the best. Thanks so much. They really appreciate it and great questions. And thank you for having me on.
Oh, thanks. And good luck.
Thank you.
For more from James, check out The James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today. For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.